I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, our conversation today about terrorism and insurgents overturning elected state governments in this country in the decade following the Civil War. But first, Israelis mourned outside the Jerusalem Seminary, where a 25-year-old Palestinian gunned down 8 students yesterday, the first deadly attack in the Israeli capital in 4 years. Today, Hamas militants in Gaza at first claimed responsibility, then backtracked. Meanwhile, in Gaza, where more than 120 Palestinians and 3 Israelis were killed in the past week, residents celebrated the shooting and mourned 3 people who were killed in a follow-up Israeli airstrike. The moderate Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is calling for peace talks to continue, but an Israeli government spokesperson called the seminary shooting a defining moment. For more, we turn to Gideon Litchfield, Jerusalem correspondent for The Economist magazine. And Gideon, a defining moment?
It's not entirely clear to me at the moment what they mean by that. It certainly changes a couple of rules of the game in the sense that this is the first time, at least that I can remember, that somebody from East Jerusalem rather than from elsewhere in the West Bank or Gaza has carried out an attack in Israel, and that means someone who has Israeli identity papers and can move freely in the country. And that changes how the security services will deal with the 250,000-odd Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem and have those papers. I don't think that it's likely at this stage to change the broader dynamic of the Israeli attempts to make peace with Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, but it certainly shifts the political balance further against that peace process succeeding.
Well, how much more do we know about this gunman, the Palestinian resident of Jerusalem? His family says he was a kid who was transfixed by the recent violence in Gaza, but he was not a member of Hamas. What more do we know?
Not a great deal more than that, at least not that I'd seen. His family say that he was a driver. There were some claims that he was a driver at the yeshiva where he carried out the shooting. The head of the yeshiva denies that. What we do know is that at his funeral there were Hamas and reportedly Hezbollah flags hanging. One of the things that was notable in the Palestinian elections that happened 2 years ago was that Hamas did quite well in East Jerusalem as well. And so there's no question that some people sympathize with Hamas, as they do all over the Palestinian territories. But beyond what that says about the young man himself and what connections he might have had himself to militant groups or anything like that, it's not clear. It's also worth remembering that there was a claim, which also has not been backed up, that this was somehow related to the killing in Syria of Imad Muhniyeh, who was a senior operative for Hezbollah of Lebanon. And Israel denied that it killed Muhniyeh, but it was a bracing for some kind of retaliation, and so there was speculation maybe this was Hezbollah getting back for that killing. But everything is still very, very murky at the moment.
That was in February, that killing. Well, we mentioned that Hamas is backtracking from a claim of responsibility, but we don't want to leave the impression that they didn't want to be associated with the killing. A spokesperson says there may be a later announcement. We don't claim this honor yet.
It's very interesting, these mixed statements coming out of Hamas, and they tell us a lot about the divisions within the movement at the moment. The political leaders who have been issuing the most recent statements have been saying, well, we're waiting to see what the military wing says, and it's telling that the military wing and the political wing are that much separated. But either way, I mean, whoever ends up taking responsibility for it, I think that Hamas would not condemn this killing because it comes a few days after an Israeli action in Gaza in which over 100 Palestinians were killed, quite a lot of them civilians and children. And whoever actually carried out the killing in Jerusalem, I think a lot of Palestinians would see it as some kind of vengeance for what happened in Gaza.
Well, you mentioned the yeshiva, the seminary, and we want to ask, it's obviously an important symbol, but is it also a controversial one because the rabbi has called it a spiritual, ideological power station for the very controversial settler movement?
There's something symbolic about the fact that yeshiva was hit, yes. I mean, the settlements in the West Bank are seen as one of the main obstacles to a peace process, and the settlers themselves have very disproportionate power in Israeli politics disproportionate to the number of settlers that there are. And so whether or not that was deliberate or whether it was just because this is a well-known and central Jewish seminary and the people who wanted to target it thought that that would be a good symbol, it's not clear.
Gideon Litchfield, Jerusalem correspondent for The Economist magazine. Gideon, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as Americans watch a divided Middle East, or Sunni-Shia divisions in Iraq, for that matter, it's easy to think of terrorism and insurgencies as foreign concepts seen only in modern warfare. But often overlooked is the bloody campaign of homegrown terror against freed blacks and their white Republican allies by Southern Democrats on American soil following the Civil War. It was called Reconstruction, but it was actually a systematic tearing down of the newly elected state governments of the New South.
A bald fact. More than 3,000 freedmen and their white Republican allies were murdered in the campaign of terrorist violence that overthrew the only representatively elected governments the southern states would know for 100 years to come. Among the dead were more than 60 state senators, judges, legislators, sheriffs, constables, mayors, county commissioners, and other office holders whose only crime was to have been elected. They were lynched by bands of disguised men who dragged them from cabins by night, or pulled off a train in broad daylight by a body of heavily armed men resembling nothing so much as a Confederate cavalry company, and forced to kneel in the stubble of an October field and shot in the head over and over again. So saturated is our collective memory with Gone with the Wind stock characters of thieving carpetbaggers, ignorant Negroes, and low scalawags, that it comes as a shock not so much to discover that there were men and women of courage, idealism, rectitude, and vision who risked everything to try to build a new society of equality and justice on the ruins of the Civil War, but that they were convinced that they would succeed.
Historian Stephen Budiansky reading from his new book, The Bloody Shirt, Terror After Appomattox. The title comes from the story of a northerner visiting Mississippi after the war. A mob dressed in white robes and hoods beat him to a bloody pulp. Then the story goes his bloody shirt was taken to Washington, where a Republican congressman waved it on the floor of Congress as a way to denounce the racist violence in the South. But instead of rallying Congress, the bloody shirt became a rallying cry for Southern insurgents. Anyone who exaggerated was dismissively said to be waving a bloody shirt. It also became a metaphor for how the cause of civil rights was set back 100 years and history of the war rewritten. Historian Stephen Budiansky picks up the story there.
There are several very peculiar things about this whole story. You would think that the people who had administered a lawless beating on someone who was only doing his job would be ashamed of the fact and wouldn't say how unfair it is to remind us of the fact of what we did. The other thing that's curious about this story is that although the beating was definitely a fact and a reality, this tale of this shirt being taken to Washington and waved on the floor of the House of Representatives, as far as I can tell, is a complete fiction.
And yet the phrase, you know, continued to be used. You begin your book with that story,
yeah.
End it with another one about a white mob that massacres blacks in the
yeah.
town of Hamburg. The men who were in the mob proudly go to trial wearing red shirts, knowing that they're going to get off, sort of mocking this idea
exactly.
of criticism
yeah.
of them. It goes to the heart of what it feels like you are saying about the South's reaction to the war, that they were the victims.
It's a fascinating theme that runs through, I think, a lot of Southern history, is this portrayal of the South as virtuous victim. A few Southerners, including James Longstreet, who I talk about in my book, recognized that having lost the war, they had a duty to accept the terms of the victors.
And we want to underscore, this was Confederate General James Longstreet, once revered as Robert E. Lee's right-hand man. In fact, it was said that if Lee had listened more to him, the South might have been better off. Longstreet writes letters to the newspaper saying the South should accept defeat. The political questions of war be buried upon the fields that marked their end. But he was vilified. And what happened?
Almost immediately, there was a concerted effort, very clearly politically motivated, of reversing the verdict of Appomattox. And terrorist violence on the part of conservative white Southerners was the major weapon that they used and used successfully.
Well, let's go back. After 5 years of brutal fighting, you paint an initial scene of joy and celebration, and for instance, in Charlestown, South Carolina. What happened there?
It was this really extraordinary spectacle of this march of joy and pride and celebration on the part of the freed blacks, culminating a month or so later in this dedication by the local blacks of the cemetery where white Union prisoners had been buried after they had died under these horrific conditions in this prison camp outside of Charleston.
Well, but almost immediately following that celebration, immediate signs that the blacks were not going to get what they expected. They had the freedom, but they weren't going to get some of the rights they expected. 100 black men approached the state convention asking for the right to vote. In a fascinating letter, they expressed joy at their freedom, but also sadness that it was accompanied by the ruin of thousands of those for whom, notwithstanding the bitterness of the past, we cherish feelings of respect and affection. Couldn't have been a more humble or conciliatory olive branch toward the white lawmakers asking for the right to vote. What happened?
To me, the most extraordinary line in that petition is where they say, "We do know the deplorable ignorance of our people, but we ask that if the ignorant white man be allowed to vote, then the ignorant colored man should be allowed to vote too." And the convention received this, immediately voted to table this petition, and the Charleston newspaper said, well, of course, we can all congratulate the convention for its wisdom in ignoring in toto this document.
But isn't some of this to be expected? I've spoken of your book to others. They've said, well, we knew that it was rough after the Civil War. The South was in ruin. Food was short. Blacks suddenly nowhere to live. Farmers nowhere to do their work.
But even the mildest demands of the victors were resisted. You know, Longstreet said, well, what did the Civil War decide? It decided the end of the Southern Confederacy. It decided the end of the claim to secession. And he said the political position of the Negro, as he put it, which meant not only was slavery over, but blacks were citizens. Andrew Johnson in the summer of 1865 doesn't even ask the southern states to recognize that blacks are citizens. South Carolina, actually, most of the delegates to their state convention even bridled at the idea of renouncing slavery. This is after they've lost the Civil War. You know, it's extraordinary. I still meet people, they say, oh, well, a majority of the southern whites were disfranchised, and that's why these carpetbag governments came in. It's just not the case.
What is the case? What was it, first and foremost, that these insurgents cared about?
It was race and nothing but race. This phrase must have been used 1,000 times in the white press during Reconstruction in the South. This is a white man's government for white men only. In election after election, the white press would urge violence, would say, carry the election peaceably if we can, forcibly if we must. The issue was nothing but race. They were not willing to allow blacks to vote.
Stephen Budiansky, his book, The Bloody Shirt, Terror After Appomattox. Now, Southerners today often say they have better race relations than the North because of their painful past. But Stephen says those gains were delayed for 100 years because of this insurgency. He'll tell us more. Later today, what to do about Democratic delegates from Michigan and Florida. We'll talk to the Democrat who heads the Rules Committee. Back in 1 minute. More from Stephen Budiansky here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with historian Stephen Budiansky's story. His book is The Bloody Shirt, Terror After Appomattox. It covers the decade after the end of the Civil War. He uses newspaper accounts and letters to tell the stories of 5 men who tried to build a new South and fulfill the war's mandate to give blacks equality. These men included a defeated Confederate general, Northerners who were labeled carpetbaggers but were the civil rights workers of their day, and the freedman, Prince Rivers, a literate former slave who served in the Union Army. Right after the war's end, he became a lawmaker and a judge in the largely black town of Hamburg, North Carolina. Then he became another metaphor for the South. Stephen Budiansky continues the story with what happened to the black town of Hamburg.
Hamburg is the setting of this horrific massacre of black members of the State National Guard unit by these heavily armed, illegal white rifle clubs who, in 1876, deliberately provoked a series of just ghastly, bloody incidents in a method that's so reminiscent of what we've seen of terrorist movements throughout the 20th and now the 21st century. trying to create incidents that will force the moderates out of the picture. The moderate whites have to choose where their allegiance is.
And the blacks, in many cases, including Hamburg, are provoked into firing back. I mean, you have letters saying that this is our goal, get them to respond.
The instigation for the Hamburg massacre is this complaint sworn out by these two local white toughs, basically, who clearly were always causing trouble in this largely black town. They try to drive their buggy right through a 4th of July parade by the Black State National Guard Company. Then they swear out a complaint claiming that the company was obstructing the road. So there's a trial to be held on this. And in the hours before the trial is to begin, hundreds of heavily armed white men looking like a Confederate cavalry company show up in the town. And Rivers sees what's coming and manages to escape and is not killed. 1877, the conservative whites, through intimidation, fraud, and violence, carry the election. One of the first acts of the new white conservative governor is to revoke the town charter of Hamburg, fire Prince Rivers from his job. And there's an obituary of him when he dies a decade or so later. It turns out the last job he held in Aiken, South Carolina, was driving a coach for a local hotel. And driving a coach was the same job he had performed in slavery. And as you say, it's a very haunting metaphor of the whole story of Reconstruction, that here was a man who escaped slavery, fought on the Union side, saw the Union victory, saw this dawning of a new age, then has it all taken away from him.
Everyone you profile ultimately fails, including Lewis Merrill, an army major sent to the South to put down the violence by the Ku Kluxers and the other white supremacist groups, the White Rifle Clubs you mentioned, who were in the insurgency. You write that the way he responded to what he had to do, to what he was charged with doing, comes right out of the Army Counterinsurgency Manual that was released just last year.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is striking that he actually succeeded in his initial assignment dealing with the Ku Klux Klan, and it was largely because he very shrewdly applied psychological warfare as much as actual military force. He infiltrated the Klan with informers, and most striking to me of all, when he finally is ready to make these mass arrests, he makes a point of saying to his men, we're going to do this in broad daylight. We're going to arrest these wanted men at their places of work. The point being, we cannot give a propaganda advantage to the other side. We cannot let them tell stories of men being torn from their bosom of their family with a knock on the door in the middle of the night. The standard sort of American bugbear of this period of what despotisms do. And a few years later, he's sent to Louisiana, where the white leagues are doing something very similar, using massive intimidation and violence to try to keep blacks from voting, to make it impossible for white Republicans to continue to support the rights of the freedmen. There he's overwhelmed by numbers, by lack of support from Washington, and he is ultimately defeated.
It's really hard to think of what this reversal during Reconstruction did to a whole people.
The Federal Writers Program during the New Deal interviewed a lot of former slaves, and in those interviews you find some recollection, almost as a sort of folk memory, of what it was like when blacks held office and had this pride, but how much of it even just vanished from the memory of their descendants is quite striking. Because, you know, it's the old cliche, the victors write the history, and in fact, the victors in this case were the Southern white terrorists.
Stephen Budiansky, his book is The Bloody Shirt, Terror After Appomattox. By the way, Stephen, are you a Southerner?
Well, I live in Virginia. I was born in Massachusetts, so what does that make me? I guess a carpetbagger, right?
Well, some would say. I mean, have you had reaction? Are you hearing from people in the South who are saying, you know, you can't write our history?
No, I haven't heard that. I was interviewed by the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina. There was just a bill introduced in the South Carolina legislature by a black representative to have the statue of Pitchfork Ben Tillman removed from the statehouse grounds, and Pitchfork Ben Tillman is really the chief villain in my book, one of the instigators of the Hamburg Massacre, and he later became a U.S. Senator and governor of South Carolina, and he stood on the floor of the United States Senate in the late 19th century and said, we had to shoot Negroes back in those days, and he was bragging about this. This reporter at the state said, I thought it was a pretty factual story describing who he was and some of the history. He said most of the reaction was favorable, but he said, I got a handful of calls of people choked with rage. And he said, one caller said, if you write another story about Ben Tillman, it'll be the last thing you do. He said, it was like all this stuff had happened last week instead of 100 years ago.
Again, Stephen Budiansky, the book, The Bloody Shirt, Terror After Appomattox. Thanks so much for speaking to us, Stephen.
Okay, thank you.
And by the way, I think I misspoke. I said the black town of Hamburg, North Carolina. It was actually Hamburg, South Carolina, but it's actually nothing anymore. It doesn't exist after the post-Civil War massacre there. Okay, still ahead today, March Madness, Farewell Brett Favre, and Spring Fever in the Grapefruit League, the week in sports, after the news here and now. What to do about Florida and Michigan? Should the two states get a presidential primary do-over, or should their combined 366 Democratic delegates get split 50-50 between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama? Does anyone have an answer? Democratic Party leaders have been huddling to come up with one, and in the middle of it all is Jim Roosevelt. He's co-chair of the DNC Rules Committee. Jim, welcome back.
Glad to be with you.
And here we go. You know, as everybody's scratching their head and trying to figure this out, we're hearing that representatives of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, party leaders from Florida and Michigan and the DNC, are all deep in negotiations. What's happening today? Is there anything going on today?
There's no specific event today, but naturally there are a lot of ideas floating around, a lot of proposals, nothing formal yet. From the state parties in Michigan or Florida.
Right. Well, let's take it one state at a time. In Michigan, in the original primary, Barack Obama wasn't even on the ballot. Hillary Clinton won. What are the options being tossed about holding a possible new contest?
There's suggestions that are being put out. First of all, of course, some people, particularly people affiliated with the Hillary Clinton campaign, say just count what happened in January that violated the rules. Some people are suggesting that there be what people are referring to as a do-over. Michigan and Florida are different situations because Michigan, up until this presidential election, has had a tradition in the Democratic Party of the state party running caucuses. So they have familiarity with running caucuses that comply with the rules.
But isn't a potential problem there that Hillary Clinton's people feel that Barack Obama does better in caucuses than primaries, so they may not go for that?
That is possible, but there also is a distinction. There are two kinds of caucuses. We all think of the Iowa and Maine sort of caucuses where people go with their friends and neighbors and they stand in a corner of a room and mm-hmm. they try to persuade each other. There's another kind that's referred to as a firehouse caucus, and in that, the state party has essentially polling places like a primary with ballot boxes. You go in, you put your ballot in the box, it's secret, and that's what Michigan has traditionally done.
Okay, so there might be a firehouse caucus in Michigan, but again, these are just being floated around. Clinton also won in Florida, although neither candidate campaigned heavily there. What are the options being discussed in Florida?
Yes, the difference, of course, in Florida is that all the candidates' names were on the ballot because there was not a mechanism for taking their names off. But the candidates did not actively campaign there. The latest idea that somebody has come forward with is that Florida do a primary, but that it be all by mail, which is what is done in the state of Oregon.
And why is a mail-in vote something that's appealing?
It's a matter of cost. Yeah. Running an actual statewide primary would cost the state between $10 and $18 million. I've heard higher figures that I don't really believe. A mail-in ballot probably costs $3 or $4 million.
Well, now, Democratic National Committee Chair Howard Dean says the DNC won't pay for new primaries, and we're reading in the paper that possibly they can't pay. The governors of Michigan and Florida say they won't pay. So,
well, this problem was created by the legislatures and the governors of Michigan and Florida, so it would seem unfair to take any money away from the Democratic campaign to pay for fixing it.
Well, now let's just stop on that note for a second, because you say the problem was created by these governors who moved up their primaries against the wishes of the Democratic Party, even though they knew they were going to be punished, and the party did punish them by saying the delegates couldn't be seated at the convention. Some people would say the party is at fault. You know, how could you ever have thought that banning delegates in a democratic process wouldn't eventually cause some problem, even without this tight race? Those states were going to demand that their delegates be seated.
The rules, you know, were fully debated for many, many months. In fact, there was a special commission, the Price-Herman Commission, that recommended this year's rules. Then they were fully debated by the Rules Committee, came twice to the full Democratic National Committee. Florida and Michigan, their delegations to the DNC, by the way, supported these rules, and Florida didn't even apply to be an early state. And the Republican Party has the same process. They're also taking away half the delegates, not just from Michigan and Florida, but from New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada for violating their rules, because they don't allow any early state.
Right. Okay, well, if I had the Republican rules guy, I'd ask him the same thing. You know, do you think the party, you know, bears some responsibility for punishing the delegates?
I think it's completely the state's fault, because it's just a matter of following the law. The Supreme Court has said parties under the First Amendment of the Constitution are the people who determine how their delegates are selected. And, you know, two members of Congress, Senator Nelson and Congressman Hastings from Florida, sued the DNC, saying that the DNC should follow what the state had decided to do. A federal district judge in Florida dismissed it at the end of argument, saying there isn't even anything to take under consideration.
Well, Democratic Senator Bill Nelson of Florida is calling this whole mess a potential train wreck. And you know, a lot of Democrats are asking, how did this happen? You know, an unpopular Republican president, an unpopular war, two incredibly vibrant candidates, and the possibility that they might cannibalize each other by the time that it counts. I mean, how worried are you?
Well, I'm not worried. I think our two candidates are discussing their different approaches. I think they are both inspiring people. And indeed, people have been saying for years, can't we come up with a method where most people in most states get a chance to express their views? Well, I think we've done it.
Well, even if there's some sort of agreement about a redo in Florida and Michigan, and money is found to do it, Barack Obama's campaign, you know, they've said they'll do what the party decides, but they don't seem happy. The word that's being used is wary. They're wary because they fear that Hillary Clinton seems to have the momentum, and it's particularly unfair now to have a revote in two states where she has the momentum.
Well, you know, 5 days ago, Barack Obama had the momentum, and the Clinton campaign was wary. It's really not our job as the National Democratic Party to tailor the process to who has the momentum. Our job is to be fair and to get as many voters heard as possible. That's what I think we're achieving. And as to how we got to this point, it's always been true in past cycles that when a state legislature decided to violate the party's rules, the state party has come up with an alternative process so that they were represented. And I'm pretty confident that's going to happen again this time.
Meanwhile, Jim Roosevelt, here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you are acutely aware that people are aware of these issues.
The level of interest in this election contest is demonstrated not only in the turnout, but for me it's demonstrated that I just can't go anywhere without people talking about it. I got on the trackless trolley bus this morning, and the driver says, "Good morning, James. You're a superdelegate, aren't you?" And we had a very good discussion about the pros and cons of the candidates.
Hey, maybe he was a mole from a campaign trying to win you over.
That would really be great organization.
Jim Roosevelt, co-chair of the DNC Rules Committee. We'll have you back next time to talk about superdelegates. Thanks so much.
Nice to talk to you, Robin.
And a quick note here, the heated race for the Democratic nomination means Wyoming is getting a lot of attention, and it's been a while. Back in 1960, Wyoming's state delegation to the National Convention cast the votes that put John F. Kennedy over the top. The state is holding Democratic caucuses tomorrow. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are holding town hall-style meetings there as they vie for that state's 12 delegates. Meanwhile, on the GOP side, John McCain, who's already locked up his party's nomination, is campaigning in Atlanta and New Orleans today. His last opponent standing, Ron Paul, is expected to bow out soon. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, politics has been wacky, but madness is about to descend upon us once again as the National Collegiate Athletic Association college basketball tournament lineup will be shaping up soon. Here to talk about that, the rest of the week in sports, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, welcome as always.
Thank you, Robin.
In refreshing for this, I'm reminded that the phrase, I don't know if this is just a myth, but I like it, that the phrase office pool sort of, you know, came out of the NCAAs and the big national excitement.
Yes, of course, you have to be very careful to add the phrase for entertainment purposes only whenever right. you mention that first phrase, and then we'll be all right then.
Well, you know, let's talk about that a little bit. First, you know, a number of college basketball conference tournaments are now underway to determine the teams that will get a spot on the road to the Final Four.
Mm-hmm.
So what games are you paying attention to now?
Well, the lesser conference tournaments are, as you say, underway now. The greater ones begin fairly shortly. The fun of these tournaments is that the not-so-great team can earn a spot in the big dance, the NCAA tournament, by winning their conference tournament. Take a team like St. Joseph's, 9-10 in the Atlantic 10 division, but they beat number 11 Xavier the other night, so maybe they go into the conference tournament with confidence. Who knows? Maybe they find themselves representing the school at the big dance.
Well, see, and now you just said it's, you know, perhaps just entertainment value only. It doesn't really matter that, you know, why do all this when the best, when it kind of come down to the best teams anyway. But, you know, there are those who say, you know, what about 1991 when number 15 Richmond defeated Syracuse number 2? I mean, it's that hope that.
Well, or more to the point, what about when the Harvard women's team beat Stanford some years ago, number 1 in the country when that happened, Stanford was. So, yes, of course, upsets are possible and upsets are definitely part of the fun. More part of the fun in the big tournament once it occurs. Conference tournaments, some of the teams that are really good, they know they're going to the big tournament. They're not worried too much if they lose to somebody in their conference tournament.
Okay. Well, let's turn to football. After 275 straight games as the Green Bay Packers starting quarterback, Brett Favre.
It's tempting to say Favre, but it's Favre.
Favre bid an emotional farewell to the game yesterday. He ended his career throwing an interception against the New York Giants in the NFC Championship game.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not going to be remembered for that errant past. I mean, my relatives in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, are taking the day off from work. They are in mourning.
Life-size statue in the living room. Yeah. The whole thing.
Really?
I'm
and
sure.
The basement, you know, the whole
Absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely.
He's going to be remembered as an icon.
Well, he is an icon. He not only did he last a great long time in the National Football League, which is an achievement of some merit, but he also was very successful and led teams to magnificently successful seasons. Beyond that, many people may not remember that back in 1996, he overcame an addiction to Vicodin. And I am always a great fan of people who recognize a dependency problem and manage to get beyond it. And Brett Favre, he did manage to play for a few more years after he got past that.
Yeah. Okay, we're about halfway through spring training. What teams are you watching?
Well, I love to look at the standings in spring training. I love the fact that Tampa Bay is on top of the American League. I don't think it's going to last, but what fun to be a Tampa Bay fan. They're 5-1. On the other hand, maybe spring training does mean something. The San Francisco Giants are 2-7, and everybody agrees that they're awful and probably will be rebuilding for some time to come. The great thing about spring training, of course, is the stories that come out of it. My favorite recent one had Atlanta veteran pitcher John Smoltz pitching to Tiger Woods the other day.
How fun.
It's great. It reminds me of the old Casey Stengel story where Sam Snead, the great golfer Sam Snead, showed up at a spring training camp where Casey Stengel was the manager, and he wanted to take batting practice, and so Stengel went along with that, and Snead couldn't hit anything. And finally, Stengel shouted out to the pitcher, "Throw one up in his eyes," meaning, you know, put one up high.
Right.
And Snead hit it a mile, and Stengel shook his head. He said, "I'll be darned, a golfer who's a high ball hitter." That's exactly the kind of story that spring training is meant for, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it has its charm, but it's big business. You got to get there early to get a ticket. I mean,
absolutely.
The games are all
selling harder than it's ever been. You better not think you're going to go to a ball game in Florida, Arizona, unless you've gotten your tickets in advance these days.
Bill Littlefield, host of National Public Radio's weekly sports program, Only a Game. Look, we have the weekend coming up. Be sure to listen. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Really coming up in 1 minute, pianist Leon Fleischer. Next, Here and Now.
Thank you.
That's the first movement of Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5, more popularly known as The Emperor. It was recorded by famed pianist Leon Fleischer with the Cleveland Orchestra under the baton of George Sell in 1961, shortly after the debilitating condition focal dystonia would rob Fleischer of the use of his right hand for over 30 years. So, Leon Fleischer taught and conducted and performed works that were written just for the left hand. Then, beginning in the mid-1990s, the deep tissue massage Rolfing, combined in 2001 with injections of Botox, gave him his hand back. Fleischer returned to recording and performing with both hands, although his latest CD, The Essential Leon Fleischer, contains past recordings of works by Brahms, Mozart, and Beethoven, including that selection of The Emperor. Fleischer is performing the full Emperor Concerto this week with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Here they rehearse. We caught up with Leon Fleischer backstage. Do you have a full use of the hand that was so impaired?
Full use, no. No, but a good percentage of the use. And it kind of comes and goes with the strength of the injection. As the injection wears off, it also wears off, does my hand.
How has this been, being back?
For me, this was a very emotional afternoon, this rehearsal. In fact, I almost lost it just sitting there during the opening tutti of the orchestra, just sitting on stage with them. I haven't seen them in a long time, and I've gone through many experiences of both exaltation and panic on that stage with them. So it was for me very emotional.
And the piece that you're playing with them, Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5, known as The Emperor?
It's a great piece. It's a piece of that involves heroism, that involves exaltation, jubilation, romping, rollicking. It's one of his happier works.
Also on the CD is a performance with the Boston Symphony of Ravel's Concerto for the Left Hand in D Major.
Yeah.
He wrote it for a pianist who lost his hand during World War I.
Right.
Here you
right
were,
hand.
His right hand.
Yeah.
And here, you know, you were performing it. It seems like an obvious question that this would have particular meaning for you.
Oh, you know, I could reply and say that piece has lost all meaning for me. I've played it over 1,000 times. It means nothing to me anymore. It just so happens to be one of the great masterpieces ever written for piano, whether for five fingers or 500 fingers. It's just a great piece of music.
What happens when a pianist is playing with one hand, even when you can play with two? I mean, what happens? Is it like a phantom limb? Does your other hand want to jump up?
No, the thing that you concern yourself when you play a left hand alone piece is that you have to sit at the keyboard differently. You have to move up towards the top of the keyboard because you do a lot of playing at the very top of the instrument there, and you need your right leg on the pedal. You can't just kind of put it out and use it there as a third leg for balance, so to speak. So you have to find your right place at the keyboard.
Because you had the problem with your right hand, we understand you took up conducting. And so how has that informed your playing now that you're playing with both hands again?
Oh, immeasurably, immeasurably. You know, music is in a sense, they say it's like mathematics. I think it's like physics. Music is movement, And the moment you get movement, physics become involved. There is direction. There is momentum. If you play a scale going up and immediately turn around and come down, it's like driving a car. You turn the wheel to the right, but your body goes to the left. And those people that play such a passage, like a typewriter, sounds like a typewriter. It's not music. But having that sense of whoosh around the corner, that's physics. We're involved with avoiding gravity. The whole length of a piece of music is the avoidance of gravity, how it mounts, how it soars, how it releases from that. I call a piece of music an adventure in anti-gravity.
Known, and other musicians have spoken of you as someone who is such a booster of 20th century composers. Mm-hmm. So I just wondered, who in the 20th century would you want to speak of as well?
Well, I've been blessed and favored by any number of composers who have written for me, such as Leon Kirchner and George Pearl and William Bolcom.
Can I tell you a great story? We'll probably cut it out, but you know, who knows how much time I'll have with you. So I live in Cambridge, and when I moved onto my block, I met this fellow Leon, who was my next-door neighbor. And I thought someone said that he was the head of the conservatory, and so I thought, oh, he must be some sort of accounting type. But he played this beautiful piano, which I heard every day through his window into mine. One day we're walking down the street, and I said, Leon, you know, that piano playing, you should keep that up. You are really good. And the next day, he said, you know, I will. The next day, I opened the Boston Globe, big black letters, Leon Kirchner debuts new piece with BSO.
Yeah, right. That's a beautiful story. You must try to keep it because it's a great story.
Well, let's just speak to him. I mean, you've just named some maybe new composers to some of our listeners. Leon Kirchner, I mean, what is it that you like about his music?
Oh, come. It's rhapsodic. It's totally spontaneous, though it's... very craftily made. No, it's very special music of today. It's quite unique in that sense.
Is there something you haven't played that...
Oh, sure, a bunch of stuff. Lots of stuff. I had 30, 35 years playing only with one hand, and the vast majority of music is for two hands, so the vast majority I haven't had really a chance to do yet.
Do you feel, I mean, gosh, this that a sense of you've got to catch up?
No. I don't have that much time left. I'm almost 80. What am I going to do? Run around, scrabble like a hen.
Pianist Leon Fleischer speaking with us at Boston's Symphony Hall. For more on his schedule, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again. Here and Now.